Miami police and the mentally ill. What do we need to do differently? A federal judge tosses Miami's district map, and WLRN's Bright Lit Place gets cool new maps. Welcome to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll speak with Ben Crump, the attorney for Donald Armstrong, the Liberty City man shot by Miami police last month during a mental health episode. Does the case revive issues about Miami police training? We'll also look at what happens now that Miami's district map has been dumped because of its racial gerrymandering. And speaking of maps, we'll talk about the new interactive Everglades restoration visuals for the WLRN podcast Bright Lit Place. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. You can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or by going to WLRN.org. Last month, on March 7th, the mother of a 47-year-old man in Liberty City called 911 because he was having a volatile mental breakdown. Miami police officers confronted the man, Donald Armstrong, on his porch. They say he was holding a sharp object, but that hasn't been confirmed. They tasered Armstrong twice, but then, as he fell toward them, one of the officers, Cassandra Mercado, fired 10 shots at Armstrong, hitting him 6 times. Here's video taken by neighbors. We warn our listeners it contains gunfire. What happened? The shots did not kill Armstrong, but did leave him paralyzed. Armstrong was later charged with aggravated assault, which outraged the local community. Nationally known civil rights attorney Ben Crump of Tallahassee stepped in this week to represent Armstrong, and he's now working to get the felony assault charge dropped. Either way, this new case revives old issues about Miami police officers' use of force record at both the city and county level, and the need to deal differently with the mentally ill. Joining me now is attorney Ben Crump. Mr. Crump, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with your efforts to get the felony assault charge against Donald Armstrong dropped. Yesterday, your co-counsel here, Larry Hanfield, said he was told by prosecutors that the assault charge will in fact be dropped and that Mr. Armstrong will only face a misdemeanor resisting arrest charge. Prosecutors are not commenting on this, however, so can you update us on where things stand at the moment, as far as you know?
That is what Attorney Hanfield indicated to me as well. However, it has not been made official, so we don't take anything for granted until we see the charges actually dropped. And even the misdemeanor charges of resisting, this is a man who is having a mental health crisis. So why would you charge him for a crime of any type unless you're trying to cover up for the wanton, willful, excessive use of force that we saw exhibited on that video that was unconscionable? It was horrific. It was deplorable. I mean, 5 of the shots hit him after he was already on the ground.
And we should mention the Florida Department of Law Enforcement and the Miami Police Department itself are both investigating the use of that force. And we'll get into that a little more later. I of course, also want to ask you, Mr. Crump, about Donald Armstrong's condition. What can you tell us about the paralysis he suffered from the gunshots last month?
At this time, he still cannot walk. He still has a colostomy bag. He still has severe pain and suffering. The bullets hit him in his back, in his arm, in his chest area. I mean, 6 bullets in his body. And so it's having an effect for certain.
What, in your opinion, and the opinion of Mr. Armstrong's family and the Liberty City community here in Miami, was so wrong about prosecutors charging him with assault on police officers in this case, given the circumstances you've just described?
Well, it harkened back to things we've experienced in the Black community far too often, especially in the Greater Liberty City area of Miami, where Blacks were routinely profiled and then having their constitutional rights violated in the most egregious ways. And then after it became obvious that the police had violated policies, had did illegal acts, had done immoral acts, then the prosecutor's office traditionally would simply try to charge the Black victim to say that we don't want to even remotely consider bringing charges against the officers who caused all of these terrible injustices to you. I say it's like smoke and mirrors. Let's go charge them so nobody will be talking about charging the police officer, the cop who shot. And it comes down to traditionally what we see after they assassinate a Black person physically, then they try to assassinate our character by charging us with trumped up charges and trying to air out any negative thing they can.
And I should mention the state attorney's office is not so far commenting on that kind of charge against prosecutors in the police department that you are mentioning. So we will wait to see what their rebuttal is to that in the coming days. But in the meantime, why, in your opinion, Mr. Crump, was Officer Mercado wrong to shoot Mr. Armstrong as he fell toward her and other officers after being tasered?
Well, clearly, you see in the video that he's having a mental health crisis, as his mother called them. She called 911 and said, "I need help. My son is having a mental episode. He has mental issues." And so they knew it wasn't a criminal call, it was a wellness call. And they came, and the mother even says on the porch there, "Please don't kill my son," which is the cry of every Black parent in America when their child has interactions with law enforcement. "Please don't kill my child."
Now,
Many of our white brothers and sisters can't understand that, but that's what we feel every time there's an interaction. None of the other officers shot, so they didn't feel in fear.
Officer Mercado was the only officer, yes, we should point out, in that group of officers who did shoot. And as far as we know, in the 911 call, Mr. Armstrong's mother did mention that he was not armed. But one of the questions involved in this case is whether Mr. Armstrong was holding some sort of sharp object during his argument with Miami police officers on his porch. Have you or anyone else been able to determine exactly what that object was? Because that seems to be a key point in the ongoing investigation.
No, we haven't. There's been speculation. However, when you watch the video, there was no need for this excessive use of force. What they're trying to do is re-engineer justification. There is no justification when you see that video. You had almost seven or eight officers. We believe it were eight officers out there, and none of the others shot when he fell. What caused him to fall towards the officers were the second was the second taser. And so it is troubling. Everybody who sees this video, we've already had experts consult with us saying this was clearly unjustified.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with civil rights attorney Ben Crump about last month's controversial Miami police shooting of Liberty City resident Donald Armstrong. Mr. Crump, I want to step back with you now a little bit and address some of the larger questions involved in this case, and perhaps the most important has to do with how police departments like Miami's deal with mental health cases like Donald Armstrong's. I want to read a part of a statement that Miami Police Chief Manuel Morales issued the day after the shooting, because he too seems to feel that things need to improve in this area. Chief Morales said, quote, "I pledge to ensure that our department does better in addressing calls involving mental and behavioral issues." So if you could sit down with Chief Morales, Mr. Crump, what would you tell him has to be done better by police, not just in Miami, but across the country in cases like Mr. Armstrong's?
You know, as we've seen in many other communities across America, they're now engaging mental health crisis medical officials, because these matters should be de-escalated. They shouldn't be escalated with tasers or any of those things. And that's not what you saw here. If you say those officers were trained, then I think this video is an example of what not to do when you're interacting with a patient with mental health crisis. And why should it be the color of your skin and the status of your mental health that determines whether you live or die? And that's what we see far too often in the Black community. Mm-hmm. And so what we have to do is constantly have the implicit bias training with police officers. But more importantly, there needs to be some protocol, some policy there,
right,
where you have officers following the guidance of mental health crises, trying to de-escalate and
right,
using deadly force as a very, very last resort.
Last resort. And that's what we're hearing from a lot of psychiatric experts who've analyzed the video, actually, of Officer Mercado shooting Mr. Armstrong. They seem to agree that police should not have been the first responders in this case or in any case like this, that trained mental health experts, as you pointed out, should have been out front. And if they couldn't stabilize the situation, that's when you bring in police officers. Is that the sort of message you're trying to convey to police departments like Miami's?
That's exactly what we're trying to do. And we keep presenting exhibit after exhibit after you see video of minorities, especially Black men, being killed by the police when their only alleged crime was they were having a mental health crisis, and
right,
then they trumped up other charges to justify the killing. We must do better, because all of us have loved ones that have mental health issues, and they should not be sentenced to death as a result.
Well, since the shooting, local community organizations here, like the Freedom House in Liberty City, have reminded the police that they have trained professionals ready to assist officers at moments like this. Freedom House even offers a mobile crisis unit for that kind of thing. Now, I don't know if the Miami Police Department would accept that kind of non-official help, but are you, for example, urging police departments around the country like Miami's to reach out more to resources like that?
I most certainly am, because any and everything is better than what we saw in that video. And we have to say, we must do better.
Right.
We can't continue to see these videos, because it makes the community lose trust in law enforcement. And that's what we have to deal with, this level of mistrust when you don't have accountability and you don't have changes.
Well, along those lines, Mr. Crump, by the same token, are there things we in the non-police community can do better in terms of reaching out to police departments, such as, for example, avoiding confrontational rhetoric like, quote, defunding police and that sort of thing that you often hear the departments themselves complain about?
Absolutely. I think we should all value and respect our police officers and understand that they play an important role in society. But in the same regard as any member of society, if they do wrong, they should be held accountable. But black communities,
yep,
Hispanic communities, minority communities, we need our police. We want our police, but we just want them to protect and serve us,
right,
like they protect and serve white communities, and not police us and protect and serve other people.
In the last minute we have here, Miami is actually one of the few police departments nationwide that offers crisis intervention training. And according to her police union, Officer Mercado had received that training. But what, in your opinion, did she seem to forget about that training? And what does that say about police departments like Miami's, what they still need to learn about the use of force in situations like this? And we only have 30 seconds, Mr. Crump.
Well, obviously it's troubling. She didn't follow whatever training that she had been given. And this is an opportunity, a teachable moment for Miami and American law enforcement
to do
better.
Mr. Crump, many thanks. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Still to come, the city of Miami's district map gets tossed and more Miami mess. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome back to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. You can make your donations to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or by going to WLRN.org. This week, a federal judge threw out the map the city of Miami uses for its voting districts. He called it unconstitutional because it's racially gerrymandered. Now Miami is barred from holding any elections with that map, which was drawn up in 2022 using what the judge called harmful racial and ethnic sorting of residents. The judge's map ruling wasn't the only bit of more Miami mess we got this week. We also found out that all of a multi-million-dollar development project meant to benefit the whole city was secretly steered to just one district, that of Commissioner Joe Carollo. Yesterday, the Miami City attorney who did the steering, Victoria Mendez, was removed. At the same time, however, Miami City Manager announced that his office at the city will stop buying furniture from his wife's family's company after a WLRN investigation discovered earlier that that company made hundreds of thousands of dollars from those purchases. Joining me now in the studio is our Miami Mess correspondent, WLRN's local government accountability reporter, Joshua Ceballos. Josh, how are you?
Tired but excited.
I can imagine. So where to start here? I guess we should kick off with the big news of the week, and that's the ruling by U.S. District Judge K. Michael Moore that Miami's district map is unconstitutional because, he says, it was racially gerrymandered. We've been watching this dispute move through the courts since last year, but is this the final word now?
It's pretty close to the final word. There's still some things that are in flux, for sure. But K. Michael Moore's ruling basically definitively says, yes, this map, the 2022 map, as well as the 2023 remedial map
right.
that the city redrew during this whole court proceeding, is in fact unconstitutional. It violates the 14th Amendment rights of Miamians, and every single districts 1 through 5, are racially gerrymandered in violation of the Constitution.
Well, remind us why Judge Moore determined Miami's district map was essentially carved up by race and ethnicity. I mean, in the end, the Miami City Commission seems to have been rather cavalier about the way it was done, no? And that was one of Moore's big complaints.
Yeah, so, this all comes up because in December of 2022, a number of civil rights groups represented by the ACLU of Florida sued over the most recent redistricting effort in 2022. But, I mean, the history goes back to 1997, when the districts were created in the first place. Prior to that, Miami had an at-large commission, so everybody ran for every seat. And the reason that the districts were created was to make sure that there would be a black representative on the Miami Commission.
Right.
And that's been the MO for all of these years. But specifically in these 2022 redistricting discussions, the commissioners were saying, it was very blatant on the commission in these public meetings, we want 3 Hispanic districts, 1 black district, which is District 5, and 1 Anglo or white district, which is District 2.
And in the end, Moore was simply telling them, in the 21st century, you just can't do things that way anymore.
Right. Yes. And even and he says, like, even if the purported reason that the city commission gave is, like, we do this to maintain minority representation on the commission, even if that's a good reason to have in your head, it still violates the Constitution. You cannot sort people based on race in voting districts.
Right. No, there's the heart of it. So, I'm glad we got to that. So what happens now? How quickly, for example, does Miami have to draw up a new map? And will it then have to hold special elections with the new map because last fall's municipal elections were held using the old unconstitutional map? What's next?
So there's some stuff in flux right now. I mean, the city was in settlement discussions already with the plaintiffs. Basically, like, it seemed like the plaintiffs had a good chance of possibly winning this. So they were already trying to reach a settlement agreement. They haven't reached an agreement yet. And so now Judge Moore's ruling stacks the odds in the favor of the plaintiffs, saying, like, this is racially gerrymandered, so the plaintiffs can kind of get what they want, but we still have to see if there's a settlement agreement or if the city tries to appeal Judge Moore's decision. But the court, in his ruling, he said the court can impose special elections,
right,
and can impose a new map of the court's choosing. So what could possibly happen here, and this is a big deal, since he said all five districts are racially gerrymandered, that means every commissioner on the dais right now could be out. They could lose their seat in a special election,
or could have to face an election.
Right? They'd have to face a special election, and they'd have to try and win their seat again. So there's a chance that the whole slate could be completely cleaned.
Wow. Okay. So this could get really messy. In the larger picture, though, Josh, what did Judge Moore seem to be saying about the Miami City government culture, its way of doing things, in the context of this map? I mean, we mentioned before that he was kind of saying, you know, the city has got to pull itself into the 21st century. But what you know, in terms of the technicalities, the way the city does business, was he saying that, you know, things have got to change?
Yeah, I mean, he's saying like the city made no effort to hide this, and it was like this is the way that we do things in Miami. We have these districts based on race, and he's saying you can't do that. And he was very blatant at the end of his ruling that Miami, this is the severe harm that Miamians have faced because they have been racially gerrymandered, and they have suffered for it. Miamians have suffered for this act of the city commission. And now the court will not allow the city to
because
do
of
it
essentially
further.
you're pigeonholing whole
right
whole,
so
whole
right because
of the population.
Because like if you're saying District 5 is the black district, then the only district where black people will have power is in District 5, and if or the only ones where Hispanics will have power are in 1, 3, and 4, and you can't do that. It should be, I mean, according to the Constitution, it should be everybody has an equal right to vote.
No, it just makes for a balkanized community, which this community can no longer afford to be anymore. So speaking of that Miami municipal mindset, let's move to another significant development this week. And this one has to do with WLRN, actually. You and your investigative partner in crime, Danny Rivero, had earlier reported that a furniture company owned by the family of the wife of Miami City Manager Art Noriega has been making hundreds of thousands of dollars furnishing Miami City government offices. Yesterday, Mr. Noriega finally said his office will no longer buy tables and chairs from his in-law's business. Right. He insists nothing illegal or even unethical was done here, but in the end, did he just really surrender to the lousy optics of all this?
It was kind of a yes and no type of situation. And just to be clear, so Art Noriega's wife is Michelle Pradere Noriega. Her family owns this company, Pradere Manufacturing, which has been a vendor with the city for many years, since before they were even married, since before he became city manager. But what we really focused on is that since he became city manager in 2020, they've continued to get contracts with the city, upwards of $400,000, selling different office products, including furnishing his own office.
Yeah.
He says that he had nothing to do with that, that there was a firewall. He has no say over the purchases for furniture in his office, but the optics are bad. And he still says, like, I don't think I did anything wrong. I think I did everything that I was supposed to do. He disclosed it when he first took office. But the commissioners, some of the commissioners, Damian Pardo, Miguel Gabela, and Manolo Reyes, said, this looks really bad. Manolo Reyes says, if it were me, I would not allow my wife to be furnishing my office because it looks bad. Yeah. So while Art Noriega says, I didn't do anything wrong, he did agree, yes, okay, my office will no longer buy furniture from her. There's been a little bit of confusion, it seems.
Right. Does that mean the entire city or just his bailiwick?
It seems like there's some confusion because Art Noriega was specifically saying, my office will not purchase furniture from her, from that company. But Manolo Reyes at one point said, I don't think that the city should be buying furniture from this company while you're city manager. But that was kind of left hanging.
Well,
and no one said anything about
it. We'll see how carries out. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Joshua Ceballos about a federal judge's nullification of Miami's voter district map and other Miami messes. Josh, let's look at another big Miami mess development this week. The city commission voted yesterday to essentially fire city attorney Victoria Mendez. She's been the subject of numerous controversies in recent years, including your and Danny Rivero's probe last year into her involvement in Miami-Dade County's guardianship program. But what do you think was the final straw or straws that compelled the commissioners yesterday to remove her?
Yeah, it's been building. There's a lot of different factors. There's yes, our investigation Unguarded was a part of it, as well as her legal advice. And she was a staunch supporter of Commissioner Joe Carollo in his personal legal battle, and argued repeatedly that the city needed to be footing the bill for his legal fees, which is upwards of $2 million. And there was a lot of people who thought the city should not be paying for this because it was in his personal capacity.
Right.
And it just kept building and building and building. There was the legal advice that she gave that almost cost the city $56 million in state tax funding. Mm-hmm. And then on the morning of the meeting where she was removed, there was a new article in the Miami Herald, which we'll talk about.
Right, yeah. This week, our news partner in the Miami Herald reported on another controversial dealing Mendez was involved with, namely a multi-million dollar land development deal from a few years back whose benefits were supposed to be spread around the city, but ended up in just one district, the district of Commissioner Joe Carollo, who's a big Mendez ally, and she helped steer things that way. So, as you mentioned, the fact that this Herald report came out just a day before this week's city commission meeting sort of added fuel to her firing. But I want to get into something larger about that. You mentioned to me earlier, Josh, that an official mentioned to you at yesterday's city commission meeting that this sort of optics, again, that word, is just going to make it harder to recruit talent to Miami city government. Is that a valid concern?
I think it's
concern.
I think a reasonable person could think that for sure. I mean, they're looking for a replacement city attorney. They have a committee looking for it, but they haven't had that many qualified candidates. And something that was said from the dais publicly was maybe the qualified candidates don't want to apply because there's so much mess and they don't want to be involved in this mess. And that kind of air of controversy can make recruitment in the city very difficult.
Now, in the meantime, Mendez will be on as an advisor still until
June 11th. So she's going to stay on staff. She'll be paid in an advisory role until June 11th. And she's going to train her replacement, who is her chief deputy. And she will also receive her pension because she becomes qualified for her pension later this month.
Right.
But she is officially no longer acting city attorney. So she is not the head of the legal department anymore.
Okay. One last one. We also learned from the Herald this week that at a Miami-Dade County Commissioner, Keon Hardiman, is the attorney representing former Miami City Commissioner Alex Diaz de la Portilla in Diaz de la Portilla's major upcoming corruption trial. Again, the optics not so great.
It's Miami mess, like you said, Tim. There's just so much going on, and yeah, it looks weird because he's in this trial, and it's weird.
Joshua Ceballos is WLRN's local government accountability reporter. Josh, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure, Tim.
Still to come, interactive maps give WLRN's Bright Lit Place podcast and Everglades Restoration a bright new dimension. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome back to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. You can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or by going to WLRN.org. Last fall, WLRN environment editor Jenny Stiletovich launched a compelling podcast called Bright Lit Place about the drama and disappointment of the now quarter-century-old effort to restore the Florida Everglades. The podcast now has an innovative digital component, interactive maps, and other data visualization, which you can find at WLRN.org and at brightlitplace.org. I spoke with Stiletovich and with Laura Kurtzberg, the cartographer and data visualization expert who crafted these innovative maps for Bright Lit Place. Jenny, Laura, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
Jenny, why was it so important to develop this sort of visual component for this particular podcast? Is it chiefly because the Everglades restoration itself is in such constant flux, so this is an especially helpful way to keep people updated on it?
Yeah, I felt like, you know, there are a lot of moving pieces and just a lot of pieces. So visually, to kind of put them together so you could see it in space, you know, the Everglades stretches and the restoration project stretches from south of Lake Okeechobee all the way down to the southern tip of Florida. So that's just a lot of land. Being able to orient yourself when you hear the story, to see visually a map that says, for example, the stormwater treatment area is below the lake. Okay, that helps me. It very much needed a visual element to...
And because we're talking about how many projects involved in this restoration.
Right. So originally there were 50 projects with about 68 components that evolved over time, too. So that original list changed.
Yeah.
And it just, in my head, it was almost a selfish act. Well, those maps were as much for me as they were for listeners and readers.
One example you guys pointed out to us was one of the main Everglades water cleanup efforts called the Everglades Agricultural Area Reservoir. That project, as it stands now, is vastly different than when it was originally conceived, right, Jenny?
Yeah, so originally it was much bigger and much more shallow. So it almost it better reflected the Everglades landscape of shallow bodies of water. When it ultimately got passed, lawmakers said you can only build it on state-owned land, and the only available land was much, much smaller. So that 60,000-acre reservoir got shrunk down to a 10,500-acre reservoir that was four times as deep.
Deep, yeah. Now, Laura, how do you go about visually explaining to our digital audience how that particular Everglades restoration project is playing out and the importance of how it's playing out in ways that Jenny just described?
For any particular project that we placed on the map, Jenny did a really good job of adding an explanation that would be kind of like that background information. We added some photography that would let people see. But the most important thing about the map itself was the location.
Yeah.
So that's something you can't really get in the audio. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot about letting the reader go and explore for themselves and click on the different restoration projects. But I think one challenge was going and finding the data that's in the right format so that we can then put it on the map, because we know what happened through Jenny's research, but being able to actually have the boundaries of different areas of the Everglades placed onto the map requires certain kinds of files and certain kinds of data processing. So finding the right thing.
And one thing, if I could just add, what was I thought really, really valuable is there are plenty of other Everglades maps out there, but they're almost like cartoon drawings. Laura actually went and found the latitude, longitude, all that technical stuff. So what you see is where they are actually located.
Yeah.
It's an actual map.
I did a lot of tracing of historic maps to find some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I mean, but as I said, Laura, you're a data visualization expert as well as a cartographer. When someone with your particular expertise is looking at such a broad and baroque effort like restoring Florida's River of Grass and all of its geographical and scientific complexities, what do you feel your biggest responsibilities and challenges are in terms of making this vastly important public mission accessible to the layperson like me?
Well, I would like to think that that is my responsibility, is making it accessible, right? That's my goal. But without taking away too much of the broad, you know, complexity of the information. So finding a balance between accessibility, simplicity, making something that's easy to understand without losing the scope of something that's so immense and so complex.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully by pairing the visuals with the, you know, in-depth audio reporting, that gives the readers who are visiting the online platform the ability to absorb this information in multiple ways. And hopefully by seeing the complexity multiple times and coming back and revisiting, they're able to find that in a more accessible way. We have one map on the platform called The Changing Everglades, and it starts by showing the history of the Everglades in the 1940s and then transitioning to a modern view of the urbanized South Florida region to really bring home the scale of the change, that we would just have this before and after view.
Yeah, that before and after is always fascinating to people. Yeah, yeah.
And not easy to track down.
That's what I was just going to ask Laura now, is how difficult and tedious can it be to track down data and information that you're able to visualize for folks when you're dealing with a project like Everglades restorations that's really still evolving?
There's a lot of data that is captured in a PDF, which is really hard to then extract.
Yeah.
Or there's a lot of information that's kind of a zoomed out view. And like Jenny was saying, we need a specific latitude or longitude coordinate for some of these things. And a lot of government data in a historic format is going to be some kind of paper that was then scanned.
Yeah.
So I, as I mentioned before, I had to actually trace some of the historic maps to look at the land use and the different types of vegetation that were present in the Everglades pre-major urbanization. And so a lot of it was tracking down the correct file, converting it into different formats, actually making the maps myself and tracing some of these things and converting them into something that a digital platform can use.
And she also did that for the growth of sugarcane farming south of the lake.
Yeah. Right.
The original footprint of Lake Okeechobee was much bigger. Laura was able to, like, you have a slider that shows how the boundaries of the lake have changed. That is something else.
That's critical to this project because the sugarcane cultivation is such an important factor in the Everglades restoration. But Jenny, this data map visualization marks a sort of culmination for the Bright Lit Place podcast, right? I mean, what to your mind have been some of the most important aspects of the Everglades restoration drama that the podcast has communicated to folks?
Well, it was important to me to go back to what was promised and what we got. And I think that Everglades Agricultural Area Reservoir is a really good example of what was promised and then what we ended up with. And that has been a factor of all the compromises and the political power brokering over the years. And that's essentially what the podcast is about.
No, it's one heck of a reality check. Yeah.
Thank you.
It really is. Jenny Stoletovich is WLRN's environmental editor, whose compelling podcast, Bright Lit Place, on the controversial effort to restore the Everglades, can be found on WLRN.org. Laura Kurtzberg is a cartographer and data visualization expert whose interactive maps can now be engaged at brightlitplace.org. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. It's produced by Helen Aceveda with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateus Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias. Merci. Obrigado.
WLRN Public Media.